Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Brian Lynn and the American History series, Making of a Nation. But first, this report.
After several years of financial difficulties, colleges and universities in the United States may finally be seeing their economic situation improving. Recent studies show that state support for American higher education increased last year for the fifth year in a row. And financial gift giving to institutions reached its highest level on record. But some experts still worry that there are still improvements that must be made. Every year, researchers at Illinois State University publish a report on the levels of financial support that state governments provide to higher education. The group released its findings for the 2018-2019 fiscal year in January. The report is known as the Grapevine. The latest one shows that overall, state spending on higher education increased by about 3.7%. James Palmer is a professor of higher education at Illinois State and the editor of The Grapevine. He told VOA that any amount of growth is a good sign, because colleges and universities across the country have dealt with serious funding problems since 2008.
That year, the U.S. economy faced a major recession, causing many states to reduce their spending, including on higher education. This led to many schools increasing tuition prices in order to cover their operating costs. Palmer says that in 1992, student tuition payments represented about 28% of the money colleges and universities were generating. In 2017, tuition payments made up 47% of that money. Many experts considered increasing tuition costs to be creating unnecessary additional barriers, especially for poorer students. But Palmer argues that states were not trying to make it harder for students to enter higher education. They simply had other competing needs in their budgets, such as health care and public education for children. And in many states, lawmakers have been reducing taxes on their citizens. Palmer admits that the past 5 years of increases in state funding have been fairly small. But the increases do demonstrate that lawmakers do value higher education and the effects it has on society. Regardless of the long-term decline in state funding that we've seen over the past 40 years, I believe that state legislators still feel very strongly that their states must maintain strong higher education systems, said Palmer. It's just that economic conditions have made it very difficult for states to increase funding for higher education beyond what we have seen.
Gifts and donations from outside groups are also on the rise. They reached $46.73 billion in 2018. That number comes from the Council for the Advancement and Support of Education, or CASE. The organization produces a yearly report on voluntary support for American higher education. Linda Durant is the Vice President of Development for CASE. She notes that donations to schools increased by 7.2% last year. Gifts of these kinds have played an important part in the finances of even the oldest American colleges and universities, Durant told VOA. Donations from companies have gone down in recent years, but gift giving from former students and outside organizations is rising. Huge donations, especially, such as the $1.8 billion businessman Michael Bloomberg gave to Johns Hopkins University last November, have gotten a lot of media attention.
Some experts say that private donations do not have as much of an effect on improving higher education, as they usually come with special requirements. A donor may demand that the school use the financial gift on a given project, like building a new laboratory or sports center. State funding usually goes toward the general operations of the school. But Durant notes that more of these gifts have been going towards things like student financial aid. That was the case with Bloomberg's donation. In fact, CASE's latest report found that gifts that went directly to fund general operations increased by about 6% last year. Andrew Carlson is Vice President of Finance Policy for the State Higher Education Executive Officers Association. His organization helps gather data for the Grapevine. Carlson says that it is mostly large, well-known schools that are able to depend on donations. He also notes that average state spending per college student is still $1,000 less than it was right before the recession hit in 2008. And during the 2018-2019 fiscal year, five states actually decreased their spending on higher education. He worries about what may happen when the next economic recession hits. Will states and institutes of higher education just be able to raise tuition, Carlson said? Will this kind of status quo be able to go forward again? I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. The term Wild West describes life in what is now the Western United States, way back in the 1800s. Life there was often unpredictable and even, well, wild. Native Americans already controlled land that white settlers wanted to occupy. So it could be a very dangerous place for everyone. Many people carried guns. Life in the Wild West has given us many expressions that we still use today. Some involve things that were widely used back then, like horses and guns. Today we talk about one of them, a shotgun. Shotguns are designed to fire a large number of small metal balls, or pellets. They travel down a long barrel before they fly out of the gun. A shotgun can hit many objects in a wide area. So this weapon is good for hunting small moving targets, such as squirrels and birds. This also made the shotgun good for protection. And that is just how settlers used shotguns during this period in American history. At that time, people traveled in stagecoaches and covered wagons, often through dangerous areas. Next to the driver in these vehicles sat a person holding a shotgun. That person's job was to guard against robbers or angry Native Americans. These days, riding shotgun still means you are sitting next to a driver, but without a shotgun. In a vehicle, the seat next to the driver is roomy. Sitting there, you can see the world around you better than people in the back seat. It is easier to talk to the driver, and you have access to the music player and climate controls. So, to guarantee that you get this good seat before a car ride, you can call shotgun. In other words, you are claiming or calling dibs on the seat next to the driver. This is a fairly common expression in American English, but it is very casual and somewhat humorous. So we usually say it only to our very good friends. I would not, for example, call shotgun on a drive with the head of my office or my mother's friend who is probably 80 years old. That would be a sign of bad behavior. The older adult should get to choose where they sit. I would even think twice before calling shotgun with a new group of friends. It could sound childish. Instead, I might say, "Would you mind if I sit up front?" And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
South Korea is seeking cooperation from China to produce artificial rain to help fight increasing pollution. President Moon Jae-in proposed the plan this week during a meeting with government officials, his spokesman said. South Korea has reached a new high in a kind of air pollution measured in fine dust. On one recent day, officials said the fine dust concentration levels in Seoul rose above 130 micrograms per cubic meter. Levels above 75 micrograms per cubic meter are considered very bad. The rising levels caused some people to wear face coverings to protect them from the thick gray air. The proposal with China would involve a project to create artificial rain. This process involves cloud seeding, when various substances are put into clouds in an attempt to cause rain. In a meeting with a top Chinese diplomat last year, Moon said China was partly responsible for South Korea's pollution problem. He called for China's cooperation in efforts to improve air quality. When asked about Moon's latest proposal, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Liu Kang welcomed cooperation with South Korea. But he questioned South Korean claims that China is a major source of its pollution. "I wonder if the South Korean side has any basis that its smog is from China," Liu told reporters. He noted that fine dust readings have been higher in Seoul than in Beijing recently. "All countries realize that the cause is very complicated," he added. One South Korean opposition party called on Moon to declare the current air pollution problem a national disaster. Lawmakers from the ruling and opposition parties held an emergency meeting and agreed to quickly consider legislation to deal with the problem. In a meeting with government officials, Moon noted that China was much more advanced than South Korea in rainmaking technologies, his spokesman said. The president expressed hope that creating rain over waters between the countries would help reduce pollution. China has claimed that South Korea's dust flies toward Shanghai, so creating artificial rain over the Yellow Sea would help the Chinese side too, the spokesman said Kim told the meeting. South Korean officials announced last month that an experiment to create artificial rain did not provide the desired results. In January, the country's weather agency sent aircraft to release chemicals into clouds over the Yellow Sea, South Korea's Yonhap News Agency reported. The Yellow Sea sits between the Korean Peninsula and China. South Korea's Ministry of Environment said in a news release that no major precipitation was observed after the cloud seeding operation. Some cloud formation was confirmed and rainfall was observed over some islands, the release said. But no rain was observed in inland areas, it added. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Ulysses Grant was elected President of the United States in 1868. Grant was a military hero. He led Union troops of the North to victory over Confederate troops of the South in the Civil War. Grant was extremely popular, but he was a much better general than he was a politician. As president, it was not long before he got into trouble in the battles of politics and government. Larry West and Frank Oliver talk about the first term of President Ulysses Grant.
Grant resigned from the army to run for president. However, he ran on his record as a winning general. "Let us have peace," he often said, and the people believed he would guarantee peace. In fact, Grant guaranteed nothing. As a presidential candidate, he offered no new national programs. So, as president, he had no new policies to carry out. He had few struggles with Congress, because he rarely asked Congress to do anything. Many events took place during Grant's two administrations, but he usually was not involved directly. He had problems only because he was linked indirectly to the men who were responsible.
One of President Grant's first problems was caused by two of his friends. They tried to take control of the gold market. The men were Jay Gould and James Fisk. Both were extremely rich. Gould and Fisk developed a plan to buy a large part of the nation's gold supply when the price was low. They would hold the gold until demand greatly increased the price. Then they would sell it and make a lot of money. To be successful, they had to prevent the government from selling gold on the market. Government sales of gold would keep the price down. So Gould and Fisk urged President Grant to stop the Treasury Department from selling gold. Grant refused to give them a firm promise.
The two men brought one of Grant's relatives into their plan. They paid him to write a letter to the president. It asked the president to halt government sales of gold. A messenger took the letter to the White House. He then sent a telegram to James Fisk saying the letter had been delivered. The telegram said, "Letter delivered. All right." Fisk thought this meant that President Grant had agreed to halt government sales of gold. So he began buying gold in huge amounts. Fisk was wrong. The words, "all right," meant only that the letter had been delivered. They did not mean that Grant had agreed to the plan. In fact, Grant did not agree. He ordered the Treasury Department to sell gold to block the attempt by Gould and Fisk to control the gold market.
The result was that James Fisk and Jay Gould lost a great amount of money. So did other businessmen and bankers. Many Americans blamed President Grant for not acting quickly enough to stop the activity of his two friends. Concern about Grant grew after another incident was reported at the New York Customs Office. Two of Grant's friends there became involved in a plan to get money from importers. They used their official positions to earn huge amounts of money.
Grant also was criticized for one of his few independent actions as president. He tried to buy the Dominican Republic in the Caribbean. The island nation was ruled by a dictator, Buenaventura Báez. Báez was so dishonest that the people of the Dominican Republic were ready to overthrow him. Before this could happen, he offered to sell his country to the United States. When Grant received the offer, he sent a White House official to negotiate with Báez. The official returned with a treaty giving the Dominican Republic to the United States for $1.5 million. Grant immediately sent American warships to the Dominican Republic. He wanted to keep Báez in power until the treaty was completed. Grant asked the Senate to approve the treaty. Many senators opposed it. They said taking control of the Dominican Republic would cost too much money. They also said it was a bad idea for the United States to take control of any nation in the Caribbean. President Grant went to the Capitol building himself to urge senators to approve the treaty. His efforts failed. The treaty was defeated.
Grant's biggest national problem was the political situation in the former rebel states of the South. After the Civil War, most Southern states were governed by radical members of the Republican Party. Radicals supported citizenship rights and voting rights for blacks. In the late 1860s, the radicals began to lose power. Many failed to be reelected to state office. They were being defeated by candidates of the Democratic Party. Democrats did not want blacks to have any rights at all.
The first radical Republicans to lose power were those in Virginia. The change there was made peacefully. Not so in other Southern states. In Tennessee, Georgia, and North Carolina, Democrats used threats and violence to win elections. Their campaigns often were led by members of the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan was a secret organization of white men. Members believed white people were greater than black people. Wearing cloths over their faces, Klansmen broke up radical Republican political meetings. They threatened, beat, and killed blacks to keep them out of politics. They did the same thing to whites who tried to organize or help blacks.
Before long, Ku Klux Klan groups were formed in every southern state. By 1871, radical Republican congressmen were demanding a new law to destroy the Ku Klux Klan. A committee headed by radicals was named to investigate Klan activities in the South. The committee heard reports of the Klan's brutal acts. It helped prepare a bill to control the Klan. After much debate, Congress passed the bill. The new law gave the president power to declare military rule in the South. Democrats charged that the real purpose of the law was to keep radical Republican state governments in power. President Grant did not wait long to use his powers under the new law. He declared military rule in a large area of South Carolina. Thousands of people there were arrested. They were tried in federal courts. Juries were made up mainly of blacks and radical whites.
This kind of justice made Southerners feel even more bitterness toward the North. It also angered a number of moderate members of the Republican Party. They said the federal government should not help radical Republicans stay in power in the South. Some of these moderate Republicans broke away from President Grant and the radicals. They called themselves liberal Republicans, and formed a new political party. They held their own presidential nominating convention for the election of 1872. They nominated Horace Greeley as their candidate. Greeley published the New York Tribune newspaper.
Democrats believed their only chance to win the election was to support the new liberal Republicans. So they, too, chose Horace Greeley as their presidential candidate. As expected, the radicals who controlled the main Republican Party nominated Grant for a second term. The campaign between Grant and Greeley was very strange. Grant made no speeches. He spent the summer at a holiday town on the Atlantic Ocean coast. His supporters, however, were not silent. They called Greeley a fool and a traitor. They refused to treat him as a serious candidate. Unlike Grant, Greeley did campaign hard, but he had little financial help. He also was hurt by a poorly organized campaign.
On Election Day in 1872, Ulysses Grant won a big victory. He got the votes of 31 of the 37 states. Horace Greeley died 3 weeks after the election. The new liberal Republican Party died with him. Ulysses Grant and the radical Republicans would govern for another 4 years.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.